Pope Benedict XVI on Saturday morning met privately with the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams. During the talks, the two men elaborated on the challenges faced by all Christian communities at the beginning of this millennium and the need to encourage forms of collaboration and common witness when addressing them. They also spoke about recent events which have affected relations between the Catholic Church and Anglican Communion, and reaffirmed their common will to continue and strengthen ecumenical relations between Catholics and Anglicans. After the meeting, the Archbishop spoke with Philippa Hitchin.
Archbishop Rowan Williams, this visit to the Vatican was being seen as particularly challenging for you in the light of the new apostolic constitution for former Anglicans seeking to convert to the Catholic Church. What was the substance of your message to Pope Benedict?
Naturally, I wanted to express some of the concerns about the way in which the announcement of the constitution had been handled and received, because clearly many Anglicans, myself included, felt that it put us in an awkward position for a time. Not the content so much as some of the messages that were given out. So I needed to share with the Pope some of those concerns, and I think those were expressed and heard in a very friendly spirit.
What was his reaction? What was the message that you received from him?
The main message, I think, was that the Constitution did not represent any change in the Vatican's attitude to the Anglican Communion as such. And a very strong statement came out, and he said that personally, but also it came out in the official statement from the meeting, that the next round of official talks, the archic procedure, should go on, that he wished to see that continue.
And yet, as you say, many Anglicans were quite dismayed at the move, which they see as a way of attracting converts rather than advancing this dialogue. What do you say to reassure them?
I would say that, first of all, the presentation of the Constitution as a kind of dawn raid on the Anglican Communion misunderstands the process that happened and the actual nature of the Constitution. People become Roman Catholics because they want to become Roman Catholics, because their consciences are formed in a certain way and they believe this is the will of God for them, and I wish them every blessing in that. But I don't think it's a question of, you know, the Roman Catholic Church, as it were, trying to attract by advertising or by special offers. I don't see that as the purpose at all. And in that sense, I don't particularly worry about it.
In your address at the Gregorian University, you asked some really quite provocative questions about the future of the dialogue, challenging Catholics to reconsider obstacles such as women's ordination and the exercise of papal primacy in the light of progress made over the past 40 years. What do you think are the chances of those challenges being taken very seriously here?
I think that if we now do proceed towards the third phase of the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission, there's a very strong chance that many of these issues will be on the table, because, of course, they are the unfinished business of what we've done so far. The possibility that the next round will look at the relation between the local and the universal church, for instance, raises, as I hinted in my lecture, both the question of primacy as it's currently exercised and the question of the decision-making liberty of the local church on matters that are not central. So I think, yes, these are precisely the issues that we need to go on talking about.
Were you able to mention them at all with Pope Benedict?
No, I think the lecture set out what I wanted to say on those subjects. I've given him a personal copy of that lecture, and we talked around the more general issues of how the dialogue should proceed.
You're also suggesting that the Anglican Communion could perhaps be a model for the Catholic Church in the way that it's organised. And yet, as you know, many Catholics believe it's hard to make any progress in the dialogue when there are so many contrasting views within the Anglican Communion. What do you say to them?
I'd say that the Roman Catholic Church is not wholly without contrasting views either. But I'd say that what we're doing at the moment in the Anglican Communion is honestly trying to find a structure of universal mutual responsibility, which is not controlled by a single executive. And of course this is hard work. Nobody expects it to be anything else. I don't think that what we have achieved is something we can hold up and proudly say everybody ought to be like this. But I would like to say that perhaps the agenda we're trying to set is something that should be shared.
How far along is this process towards a covenant?
Well, we should have the final draft in a couple of weeks. Once that is in front of the Standing Committee of the Communion, at the beginning of December, then it'll go straight out to the provinces, and the procedure will begin of assessing and adopting the document, we hope.
You dedicate a lot of your time and energy to questions of reconciliation within the Anglican Communion, people who can't accept some of the positions taken by the Communion. What are your feelings towards the so-called traditional Anglican Communion, the people who are other groups considering conversion as the best kind of option?
As I said earlier, people become Roman Catholics out of conviction, out of conscience. Good for them. Those of us who do not take that route do so because we believe that there are still questions unresolved. Now, among those who don't become Roman Catholics are some who would be very traditional Anglicans, who would not be wholly happy with the direction that the Communion has taken about the ordination of women, to take the most obvious point. I won't go into the question of homosexuality because the position of the Communion remains exactly what it was 10 years, 11 years ago. So I think what I would say is simply that within the Communion there is a broad spectrum of accepted, understood theological positions that varies from those who are wholly committed to, let's say, the ordination of women, to those who believe it is at best a subject that we ought not to be discussing on our own, we ought to be resolving with other churches. But it's all within one spectrum. I don't want to see that spectrum narrowing. And that's why I'm concerned to keep as many people as possible at the table.
You mentioned the other, perhaps we can call it elephant in the room, the question of homosexuality, which is so bitterly divisive within the Anglican Communion, let alone between the other churches in dialogue. What are your hopes? Where are we headed on this particular question, do you think?
Nothing really new to say on that, except that my hope has been consistently that we keep in step with one another, that parts of the Communion don't rush ahead with change before everyone is convinced that it's the right change. So we have to keep considering this, praying about it, reflecting, without creating too many facts on the ground that pretend the debate is over and has been settled in one direction. But also, I hope, with a sense that we do value and appreciate the contribution made already by many, many faithful gay and lesbian people who serve as clergy and laity in the church and live according to the church's stipulations.
Have you had any talks around these issues here in the Vatican this time?
On that issue, no.
As you know, there is a possibility of a papal visit to the UK planned for next autumn. What kind of welcome do you think Pope Benedict might receive in Britain today outside of the Catholic community?
I think a great deal will depend on the degree to which the Pope is encouraged and assisted in speaking to the whole of British society, not just to the Roman Catholic component. I think it is quite significant that Cardinal Newman is the main focus of the visit, because Newman, of course, is not just the property of the Roman Catholic Church. He was one of the great public intellectuals and literary figures of the 19th century. And I have encouraged the Holy Father to think about Newman in that sense as a foundation for things he might want to say to British society, and I'm sure others have done exactly the same.
He is, of course, a convert, and in the current situation might be seen as more of a division than a source of unity.
Yes, in the current context, I think that the legacy of Newman looks a little bit more shadowed than it might have done perhaps 12 months ago. But the other side of that is that once Newman was a convert, he continued to be part of the public discourse of intelligent British society. He didn't himself address or try to speak for just a narrow band of British society. His work on education, his work as a philosopher, his literary production, his preaching continued to be addressed to the broadest possible Christian concerns in a society that was already feeling the effects of a kind of secularization. Now that's the Newman I think we all want to hear more about.
On one other issue, at the beginning of December, you'll be leading an ecumenical service in Copenhagen ahead of the climate change conference there. This is a real priority for you, isn't it today?
Yes, it is, definitely.
What are you hoping will be achieved? What is your message to world leaders gathering there?
I think the main message is twofold. First of all, there is no possibility of pretending that this is anything other than urgent. This is a a major issue confronting us now. Whatever the detail of the science of climate change, the facts of climate change and the facts of environmental degradation are there to be seen. And I was speaking a couple of weeks ago to a political leader from the Pacific region, who spoke of how he and his government were preparing a DVD to be shown at Copenhagen, which illustrated the immediate effect. So that's the first thing. It's urgent, it's visible, it's immediate. The second thing is, care for the environment is a good thing to be involved in, whether or not we avert the disasters of climate change. It is a better life to live in harmony with God's creation than otherwise. And so we have to do this because it's right, because it's a life-giving, life-enhancing way of approaching our environment and indeed serving God. So yes, it's urgent. Yes, it's right. Put those together and the conclusion is rather obvious. Do something.
You took your own no-fly pledge, didn't you? You've been very much trying to put this into practice in a very personal way. Would you like to see other faith leaders being more outspoken, leading on this again?
I'd very much hope to see more and more faith leaders coming on board with this. A couple of weeks ago at Lambeth Palace, we had a meeting of faith leaders with the Secretary of State, and a joint statement was produced representing all the nine major faith traditions in the United Kingdom. So there is already a lot of movement there.